Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today I'm walking the trails of Fort Worden with Eric Kingfisher. We're looking for and going to be talking about our native broadleaf trees, especially the madrone, the big leaf maple, and the red alder. This is the second of my conversations this summer with Eric about the native trees of the Quimper Peninsula and the Pacific Northwest. Our first conversation was about conifers, and it initially aired on June 24th. Eric is the stewardship director for the Jefferson Land Trust, and he's also a local and statewide leader in conservation stewardship, and, of course, he does amazing, innovative educational programs. Among Eric's many accomplishments is the fact that he provided the inspiration, designed, and is a major teacher with the very popular Jefferson Land Trust Northwest Naturalist course. And this year, with our Stay Home, Stay Healthy world, Eric was one of the key naturalists for the Jefferson Land Trust Nature in Your Neighborhood program. And Nora Petrich is along, too. Nora is one of Nature Now's sound editors. We're on the path, actually, it's between the forest and the Chinese Lagoon. In addition to all the conifers, we can see a really fine-looking madrone. Red alders, and there's another fine madrone if I just turn around. So let's start with the madrone. So I suspect almost all the listeners know what a madrone looks like because it is such a unique and characteristic tree. But Eric, help us visualize.
Yeah, so our last session, we talked about all the different conifers, some of the main conifers, and we talked about how we live in a land of trees, right? And we live in a land mostly of conifers and mostly of big conifers. And the broadleaf trees are what we're going to be focused on now. And the broadleaf trees, what we mean by that are the trees that actually have those leaves that you and I all know, as opposed to a needle-shaped leaf. Our broadleaf trees, we have many, many kinds, but we have three main kinds that I think it's important, really, for everyone to kind of be familiar with these things as a sort of sense of place here. And I hope your listeners will be inspired by some of this to go out and familiarize themselves with these trees they aren't familiar already, or become more familiar. There's lots of different features of these trees that are wonderful to just get to know better, like the madrona. So one thing I think is interesting about the madrona or Pacific madrone or arbutus is it has all these different names. There are different geographic references. So when you're in British Columbia, people call it arbutus. And when you're in Washington, typically it's referred to as madrona. And then like in California or Oregon, it's more often referred to as madrone.
But we're talking about the same tree.
But it's all the same tree. And there are several kinds of madrones in the world. And like we've talked about on our last show, we have a lot of the biggest of the trees in the Pacific Northwest, including this. This is the largest plant in the entire heath family, the entire Ericaceae family.
And it's really interesting to me because when I think about the heath family, it's the heath, it's the heathers, it's the blueberries.
Exactly.
It's the things that are mostly shrubby.
It's a salal, it's a rhododendron.
Right. And these things, they can get gigantic.
Yeah, they're big, beautiful trees. So the madrona has this reddish bark, and that's really the most distinctive feature. It has these beautiful leathery leaves as well. But the distinctive bark is reddish, and then it also peels away and reveals that undergrowth, the underbark, at some point or another. Now, there's some portions of the trees, like on this tree that we're looking at, there's portions that have multi-year accumulations of some of that bark, but there's also most of its trunk is smooth, and it's going to be peeling its bark as it grows older.
We were talking a little bit before we started our walk about what might be the adaptive advantage for a tree to shed its bark.
I've read a little bit about this, and there's several different kinds of trees that have that exfoliating bark, that's just shedding bark for one reason or another. And what is the adaptation advantage for that? What is the evolutionary adaptation there? I don't think there's a real consensus on that. I think there's a favored understanding that it could be because it helps shed away potential pathogens. As maybe insects lay eggs, like wood-boring beetles or something, lay eggs on the bark, then that bark sheds away. It doesn't have that threat of that, of those larvae hatching and digging into the bark or into the tree itself.
And what is the relationship with the wildlife and the birds?
So it does have an abundant crop of berries that it creates every year. And one of the ways you know it's in the heath family is it's has these little bell-shaped flowers, really fused petals all together, four or five fused all the way together to make this little bell shape, which is similar to what you see on your blueberry plant or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then those eventually become these beautiful, vibrant red berries that then are a favored food for a lot of different wildlife, particularly birds, band-tailed pigeons, the thrushes, the robins, all of them. And then they distribute their seeds. And that's one of the main ways that the madronas are able to distribute their seeds.
And I understand the Native Americans use those seeds somewhat for eating, but that they're pretty astringent.
Yeah, I guess it would give you cramps if you ate too much. But yeah, I mean, they're edible, but they're not an important food source.
And then I've read somewhere that they also use the bark and the leaves to make various kinds of potions, I guess, for stomach aches, skin ailments, sore throats, etc. I guess it's probably as a tea as well.
Sure. Yeah, so and they grow a lot of places. They grow up into the northern stretches of the Salish Sea up into British Columbia. We're sort of near its northern extent, the madronas. And then they go all the way down into Santa Barbara area, even up in the Sierra Nevadas, you know, in a few locations. So they have pretty big range, though we are at the northern end of its range. And that's been part of why we've seen some disease on these trees.
Yeah,
that's how it's been explained to me.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of on the edge of its range, then it's going to be a little bit more stressed and more susceptible to certain diseases. And it's got several different pathogens that it's pretty susceptible to a certain kind of root rot, sudden oak death kind of disease. And so there's a lot of different things that are not working in its favor. And so sometimes you see different fungal diseases on the leaves or whatnot, and they're just doing their best and trying to get through. And like I said, they're at their northern end of their range, and some sites are better than others.
Well, in terms of sites, I think about them as often interspersed among the conifers.
Yeah.
But often near, like we're near the edge here, the forest, where it's a little drier.
Right.
I guess the question then is, are they especially drought tolerant, or do they have something that allows them to live in that potentially stressful area?
Yeah, they're really drought tolerant. They like really drain soils too. I think what's interesting about this tree that we're looking at here, so we're on the edge of a forest between the shores of the Chinese Lagoon and the Douglas fir dominated forest here at Fort Worden. And all the Douglas firs, of course, are growing straight up.
Right.
They have a growth form that sends them straight up in proportion to gravity. That's not what we're seeing here with the madrona. It's actually twisted and curved and reaching out. So it's a growth form of all these broadleaf trees, really. They'll kind of reach out and find that sun. And oftentimes in these Douglas fir dominated forests, you do have, especially up here on the Quimper Peninsula, especially here deeper in the rain shadow, you have madronas growing amongst all this second growth Douglas fir. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful. They grow these weird spindly sort of twisted looking skinny trunks that are reaching up and trying to compete with the fast growing Douglas fir. They're a feature of these forests that I think is just really beautiful. And then what they're doing is really trying to find those gaps. And so like this one is growing, I don't know, it's probably 30 feet or something from its trunk. Its main crown is like 30 feet from its trunk in one direction. And that's called just phototropic growing. So
the leaves are not typically what we think of as deciduous. They don't drop every winter.
Right. It's the most northerly evergreen broadleaf tree on the continent. So the way that a lot of broadleaf trees grow is they are deciduous, meaning they lose their leaves in the winter and regrow them in the spring. And here, the madronas in its entire range, they're just evergreen broadleaf trees.
Mm-hmm. So leaves last a couple of years?
Yeah, a couple of years, and then they'll drop off. And they have. If we look up at this one, we see probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 inches of fresh growth of leaves. And then you've got some other, you see some yellowing ones down below. Those are going to be from last year or the year before.
So let's walk further down this trail, and let's see if we can find either the red alder or maybe even a big leaf maple.
Yeah, sounds fun. Okay.
So we've wandered down the trail a bit, and we're still kind of on the border between the forest and the pasture in the Chinese Lagoon. And here is a cluster of just some really quite glorious red alder. Let's see, I'm going to guess these are not the hugest I've ever seen, but these are a good 50 or 60 feet tall.
Yeah.
And so, Eric, give us just a bit of a visual description.
Sure. Okay. So red alders are one of our most abundant broadleaf, probably the most abundant broadleaf we have. And so I think listeners probably have some familiarity or would recognize them. And they're trees that have what looks kind of like gray bark, sort of a grayish bark. And they have these vibrant green leaves with serrated edges. And they grow in a lot of different forms, sometimes in a very, very straight trunk, straight up. Other times they're leaning one direction or another, or multi-trunked, or coming out in sort of a basal splay of different trunks. And what we're looking at here, we've got four alders, looks like all in a bit of a cluster, and their branches are coming out as low as maybe 8 feet off the ground, and they go all the way up, different branchings, different sides of the tree, all the way up to the top. And yeah, they're probably in that 50, 60 foot range at this point, maybe a little bit even bigger. And their branches are lateral. They go quite far. They're probably 30 feet out on, sunlight. Again, reaching out to get the sun. Because on the backside of this alder set is just more conifers and more shade. And there's not a lot of branches on that side.
So the leaves, now this is a deciduous tree.
Yeah.
Sort of oval, you can see serrated edges on them. Anything else we want to note about the leaves, other than they're filtering the light in this late afternoon, just beautiful.
Yeah, it's really pretty. Yeah, they're probably 3 or 4 to 6 maybe inches. Typically, these are about full grown now. You know, in the early spring, they're smaller, and now midsummer, they're going to be about as full grown. So maybe 6 or even some of these, maybe 7 inches long and like sort of an oval shape, like you said, with a pointed end. They have veins that you can see on them, and they're really just distinctive, but they're very pronounced veins on both sides. They're a little bit raised on the bottom side of the leaves. And they grow in abundance. You know, they're not shy about all their leaves. They make a lot of leaves. Your listeners, if you look out your window and you see a broadleaf tree, chances are it's a red alder.
And then they're sometimes called pioneer species. What does that mean?
Sure. So red alder has a lot of functions, a lot of roles it plays in this big community of life out here in these forests and on the land. Its most well understood and pronounced one that foresters know about and scientists know about, ecologists know about, is their ability to what's called fix nitrogen. They can take atmospheric nitrogen from the air and turn it into nitrogen that's available to them and put it also into the soil.
Atmospheric nitrogen is not usable by
It's not usable by other plants. So it actually has a symbiotic relationship with the bacteria that allows it to convert that atmospheric nitrogen to nitrogen that it can use. And then it also transfers nitrogen into the soil. It actually makes the soil more fertile.
So it's like creating fertilizer.
Yeah, basically. In a disturbed site, when you have, say, a big wind event where a bunch of trees fall down, or, of course, a clear cut, then you're going to see alders coming in first. I mean, these broadleafs do a great job of replacing that space and recharging that space with more fertile soil. And they also grow very fast. You know, in 5 years, you can get a 15-foot alder. In 40 years, you maybe have like an 80-foot alder. You know, these things grow relatively fast.
Do they die out once the conifers get more established and create more shade?
Yeah, so they don't live that long compared to their conifers. I'm looking at some cedars over here, and cedars have been known to grow for over 1,000 years.
Right.
Douglas fir, 4 or 5, maybe even 800 years old in some cases.
And these guys said,
and these are 70-ish? Pretty much done by 70 years or so. Of course, there's exceptions to all this, but after about 60 or 70 years, you look up to the top of these alders and you start to see branches that aren't creating any leaves, and they're dying, and they're going to start dropping their branches, and eventually the tree's going to fall over, and in a sense, it's kind of done its job, and it's not typically going to be replaced by other alders. It's going to be replaced by some of these conifers that are growing underneath it.
And I've read that it's called the red alder because if you scrape its bark, you get a reddish color.
Yeah, there's a reddish hue in the, or tone to the inner bark. It's beautiful. It's kind of an orange red.
As I was sort of going, I was reading that the Native Americans, of course, they used the bark and the wood, but they used that red dye.
Mm-hmm.
They used it to dye their fishing nets.
Yeah, to make them more invisible.
Right, because red as a light color doesn't penetrate water much at all, so it essentially becomes black. Very clever.
Yeah, and there's medicinal qualities to the bark as well. It's been used for thousands of years for that reason. And, you know, I mentioned that it has this sort of grayish bark, and that's another distinctive thing about red alders is it's actually, you're typically not actually seeing the actual bark. The bark is covered pretty much entirely by several different species of crustose lichens, these different little lichens that grow in patches all over the bark. So next time you're at a red alder,
get up to that one there, we see hints that
you can see sort of splotchy patterns. And those splotchy patterns are just different organisms, lichens, that are on there growing and reproducing and totally covering the bark. And I don't know if there's like actual symbiotic relationship going on there with regards to the alder benefiting from that, but it specifically has been known to be an indicator of air quality. So you see a lot of lichen on the bark, and it's suggesting that there's good air quality. In places where there's a lot of air pollution, the lichen just doesn't grow on the bark as well. And so something to, you know, be mindful of, or you can kind of do your own observations out there.
You know, and something else I was reading about alders, I was getting ready to have this conversation with you, Eric, and it sort of reinforces a reason that we should protect biodiversity in our world. That, you know, the Native Americans certainly used the bark for various traditional medicine things.
And continue to.
And I've also read that scientists have found that there are some really very special compounds that are effective in treating cancerous tumors. That I have two names, butylin and lupiol. I don't know those names, but it's kind of cool to realize that, you know, the Native Americans had their wisdom, and if we still have the alders, we can add to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Biodiversity is it's a treasure, and it's our job as stewards of the planet to do our best to retain as much as we can, I think. Yeah, lots of different organisms like the alder, too, living on the alder and using the alder. And it's, you know, we talked earlier about the big trees. You know, we have some of the biggest kinds of trees in the world, and we have talked about the Madrona being the largest of all the heath family. Well, this red alder is the largest of all the alders in the world.
And I know we were chatting a little bit earlier, if we're going to go looking for a big leaf maple, but that's the biggest of the maples.
That's the biggest of the maples too,
yeah. North America. And so that kind of asks the obvious question, why is it that the Pacific Northwest has so many species that are the largest of their group? And we found that when we talked about the conifers too.
Yeah. Generally, I think of that as being related to just the mild maritime climate that we're in, and the fact that these trees, especially the evergreen trees, can grow virtually all year long. And so they have just a really good growing environment, and that allows them to reach their larger size. It's just well-suited in that way.
So I think we need to go find a big leaf maple, which we haven't seen very many years.
Yeah, well, you know, we noticed on the other trail on that edge we were on earlier, we're seeing the Madrona. We didn't see any of these red alders or big leaf maples, and they tend to grow in different areas. And what we're seeing here with the red alders is they're in a little bit of a draw here, where there maybe is a little bit more water accumulation, and that's typical of the alders. They do very well in the wet environments, riparian areas, you know, along streams and rivers and lakes. And that's the same thing for a big leaf maple. Now, big leaf maple has, I think, a little bit more variation on where it can grow than red alder.
Well, we're down in another part of Fort Worden, down near the beach campground, because this is one of my favorite places to always find big leaf maple. And it's a favorite place in the springtime, too, because when they bloom, they're just this wonderful bright yellow, and they're sort of
like a tassel of flowers.
It's great. Yeah. Now it's middle of July, and that's past their peak.
Yeah, the fruits are now ripening. They're forming or maturing into a form that eventually they'll dry up enough to then break away and blow away. And they have it's a winged seed. The botanical term for that is Samara, name of my daughter. And they blow away in the wind, and they basically fly away in that sort of helicopter form,
action. Yeah, that's also typical of maples.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it was the name of your daughter. How cool is that? And I also think, you know, the big leaf maple is probably one of the most aptly named trees I've ever met. So, Eric, you've got a leaf there.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, biggest leaf of a maple tree, and it's the biggest of all maple trees. 115 species of maples in the world. We have 3 species of maple here in the Pacific Northwest and in Jefferson County. We have the 2 others that you might be familiar with is the vine maple, which grows in sort of a tree form, but more of like a shrub form.
Yeah.
multi-stemmed and wet in locations. And then the Douglas maple, which is a little bit less common, or a lot less common. There's one in the Quimper Wildlife Corridor that I know of, but I don't know of a lot of other ones around here. If you pay attention on your next drive up Hurricane Ridge, there are several Douglas maples in those dry exposed slopes. Mm. It's a plant that likes more dry environments. But yes, here we are with the bigleaf maple. It's a big, beautiful tree with a big crown.
Huge tree.
And you know, these things will grow in lots of different environments. Typically, their most sort of favorable environments where they grow the biggest and become the most lush are those riparian areas that have a lot of moisture, a lot of water. But they can also grow in rocky areas too, where there's light, where there's gaps in those conifer.
Well, and these also may be just catching some of the water that comes down the bluff behind them.
Sure enough, yeah.
And,
yeah, which is why we see so many here on the slope near the campground, I expect. But yeah, nice big leaf, and it's got several points and lobes in it, you know, typically 4 to 5 or so lobes, and then got, it's bigger than your hand. If you splayed your hand out, it's going to be even bigger than that.
I think it almost get to be like a foot across.
Yeah, 12 inches or so, yeah.
And I think about, of course, growing up in the Midwest and New England, maples meant sugar maples, which meant sugar maple syrup. Do you know anybody out here who makes bigleaf maple syrup out of this?
The University of Washington is running an experimental trial of trying to make it a commercially viable product. And so they're using experimental forestry to harvest maple sap. And I think it's something like 10 to 1 compared to sugar maples. I don't remember the ratio, but it's like the whole lot of sap has to be
to get the same amount
used to get
syrup.
Down to the same amount of syrup,
We've done our 3 broadleaf trees.
Yeah.
Glad we came down there because these are just beautiful.
Yeah, spectacular tree. Yeah, so I hope that even those who are listening who have some familiarity with these 3 trees, they can identify them, they know them. I would just encourage folks to take a closer look. Find something you don't know about them. If you take a close look at the leaf, you'll take a close look at a stem, take a close look at its pollen cones, take a close look at the different stages of growth of the seeds or the flowers or all those different things. The more you spend time with them, the more you get to know them and become more familiar.
So I have one more thing to talk about, and that is I wanted to share that this week I met a young woman in Port Townsend, brand new to the area, and we were talking about things that interest us, and she became aware that I was really interested in the natural world, and she asked me a question. So listen up. The question is, as a newcomer, what is the single most important thing that she needs to know and to understand, to sort of feel rooted in the natural world around here? When she said the single most, it just really stopped me cold, and I had to really think about that a bit. I'll share what I thought about, but first I'm going to ask Eric.
I think when I think of the Quimper Peninsula, what makes it interesting or what stands out about its ecology and its presence is the fact that it's pretty deep in the rain shadow. In Port Townsend, we only get about 19 inches of rain a year. Mm-hmm. And that goes up as you go further south. You know, Chimicum area, you're going to get in the 25, kind of 30-ish kind of inches of rain a year.
Seattle's in the 40s.
Yeah, somewhere. Seattle's like 40, 45. And then Quilcene's pushing like 60 or more. Mm-hmm. And then you go up the river valleys, you get even 90 or even 100. And so up here in the Quimper Peninsula, around Port Townsend especially, it's quite dry. We just don't get as much rain as most of the rest of the Puget Sound trough, or really the Northwest.
Okay. And Nora, you're a long-time resident.
Right. And what I thought of with that question, and it's probably because I'm a mariner, I think of the way the Quimper Peninsula pushes out into the straits and these very foggy, cold marine systems that can come in and cover the entire peninsula and make it very, very cold in those.
We love those mornings when it's like that.
But I find it quite unique. You don't get those sorts of systems down in Lower Sound.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the thing I thought about is I thought about glaciation and how if you just look at a map of the Quimper Peninsula, you see these sort of long valleys and grooves where the glaciers have been. And, of course, we're at Fort Worden and we see massive glacial till deposits, and we see sandy deposits that there were sedimented out from the bottom of glacial lakes. So that's how I answered it.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm going to suggest if anybody out there in our listening audience thinks about it and wants to add to this conversation, just drop us an email. It's naturenow@kptz.org. Well, and that's it for this week's Nature Now. Thank you so much, Eric, for wandering around Fort Worden with us.
Yeah, it's fun.
Thank you, Nora, as well. Nature Now airs Wednesdays at noon, just a little bit after the community news section. Thursdays at 5 and Saturdays at 12:30. The closing music. It is a song called The Forest by Mackenzie Madrone.
From the forest.